Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault, and boy, do we have a treat for you. This is a grand old episode. Robert, I know you're very excited about this one. When did this originally air? In 2014?
Yes, this is a much older episode than a lot of the other vault episodes we've discussed. It published August 26th and 28th, 2014. It's a pair of episodes that Julie Douglas and I put together that discuss the history of syphilis, how the science of syphilis, how syphilis works. Yes, the sexually transmitted disease syphilis. And it is just a fascinating topic. It's easily one of my favorite episodes of all time. So we've taken those two episodes and stitched them together into one episode. So it might be a little clunky at times, but all the information is definitely still valid.
Will there be vampires?
Oh, there will be vampires. Be prepared for the syphilitic vampire.
All right. Well, let's go right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And I'd like you to take a moment to just try and create, try and imagine the most destructive disease possible. Imagine a disease that ravages the body, that ravages just about every tissue, every part of the human form, that it takes down the sex organs, that takes apart the face, takes apart your identity, and in some cases ultimately robs you of your mind as well before killing you outright.
Yeah, you mentioned sex organs. So also imagine that there's a moral dimension to this disease that would give you the sort of outward appearance that perhaps you had been engaging in conduct unbecoming to you.
Yes. And of course, in all of this, we are talking about a very real illness, and that is syphilis. We're actually going to devote two whole episodes to syphilis here. This first episode, Syphilis the Great Imitator, is mainly going to focus on the organism that causes syphilis and how syphilis manifests itself in the human body. In the second episode, we are going to get into the cultural and historical impact of syphilis, because that in its own right is an enormous topic of interest, because for 4.5 centuries, syphilis ravages the old world, ravages Western culture, and it's really kind of difficult to overstate the role that syphilis played in coloring Western civilization during that time.
Yeah, so don't run away because this is all really interesting. The bacterium itself is fascinating. And then, of course, the cultural implications. Now, we had our first recorded epidemic of venereal syphilis occurring in Europe in 1495. And by the close of the 15th century, you have chaos just reigning in Naples, Italy, where there was a huge outbreak. In fact, Pope Innocent VIII asked French King Charles VIII to invade the city with troops to try to keep it under control. But what do you think happens?
Well, as we would eventually learn, sending troops in to deal with syphilis, not the best strategy. Because they're going to end up catching the syphilis, and then when you draw the troops out, they're going to take the syphilis elsewhere.
Exactly. And the problem here is that syphilis is being known as the great imitator because it has all these different symptoms that at the outset might be mistaken for other illnesses. So imagine this time period in which this was happening and people not quite knowing what they were dealing with.
Yeah, to quote Sir William Osler, he says, "No syphilis in all its manifestations and relations and all other things clinical will be added to you. There is no organ in the body nor any tissue in the organs which syphilis does not invade, and it is therefore manifestly difficult to speak, at least at all concisely, of the pathology of the disease, just as it is almost impossible to describe its clinical symptoms without mentioning almost every symptom of every known disease." And these symptoms are not going to be the same from one person to the next. Mm-hmm. So you have a disease that is seemingly very stealthy, very nefarious. It's changing its shape. It's changing its strategy. It's going dormant. It's popping back up. And the whole time, everyone's trying to understand what's going on, how to prevent it. Again, there's this whole seemingly moral side to it because it spread through sexual contact, and it ends up spreading across every social level in society. It's a disease that ravages the poor. It ravages the rich. It's hitting the royalty. It's hitting the clergy. It's hitting anyone who's engaging in sexual contact.
Which is everyone, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, it is so prevalent that you get a couple of references to it in Shakespeare's works, like pox of your houses in Romeo and Juliet, which is now a curse, like a pox on you.
The pox, yeah.
But the problem with this is that we tend to think of it as this antiquated illness, right? It is not, in fact, the Centers for Disease Control estimate that annually more than 55,000 people in the U.S. get new syphilis infections. And during 2012, there were more than 49,000 reported new cases of syphilis compared to 48,000 estimated new diagnoses of HIV. So it is still present, and it is most common in people between the ages of 20 and 29 years of age, which has led it to be called Cupid's disease, by the way.
Yeah. And of course, one other way we should mention that you can transfer syphilis is through an unborn child. And so congenital syphilis, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, that's also a huge problem because when syphilis manifests in a newborn child, the effects can be pretty disastrous. So once again, syphilis, even though it is of tremendous interest from a historical standpoint, it is not a purely historical disease.
No, we just don't put as much emphasis on it these days in terms of infectious diseases because it can be controlled by penicillin, and we'll talk about that later.
Yes, it can be wiped out by penicillin, and that has been a huge advantage in the war against syphilis for sure. But still, it is an adversary that carries on even in the advent of what would seem a magic bullet.
Yeah, and let's talk about this dastardly organism, also known as Treponema pallidum.
Yes, Treponema pallidum, which is a treponemal disease. There are other treponemal diseases, which we'll get into. These include Bajul, Penta, and Yaws. None of these, of course, are sexually transmitted, but they are essentially skin ailments that are transferred by skin-to-skin contact.
Yes, so they are related to Treponema pallidum, but they themselves, as you say, are not spread through sexual contact.
And I should add, to be clear, if you want to get really particular, syphilis is caused by a subspecies of Treponema pallidum, essentially Treponema pallidum. But for all intents and references going forward, Treponema pallidum, T. pallidum, syphilis, you'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Now, this is a spiral-shaped bacterium, also known as a spirochete. And we're talking about slender, spirally undulating bacteria here. And again, it is most often spread by sexual contact. And the disease occurs in three primary stages. We'll talk more about that. And these later stages that we'll discuss are not so common in our modern era.
Right, yeah, because the later stages obviously deal with a case of syphilis that has not been treated, not been cured with penicillin. All right, well, let's talk about how syphilis is transmitted. And I'd like you to think about this in terms of an invasion, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with an invasion of these spirochetes into the human body. And this invasion takes place in a few different phases. So syphilis can be spread, again, by through the birth placenta, by kissing, close contact, transfusion of fresh human blood. But the main ways that it's spreading is through sexual contact. We're talking vaginal sex, oral sex, anal sex. All of these will serve as an entry point. Now, the way that the spirochetes enter the body, they enter through the skin. And when intimate contact of this nature is made, that is when the spirochete enters the body, enters through the skin.
And there it will hang out until it makes itself known in the form of a syphilitic sore, also known as a chancre. And chancres occur mainly on external genitals, the vagina, anus, or in the rectum. They can also occur on the lips and in the mouth. So this is when you see most of the transmission occur among people, when these sores are present.
Right. This is primary syphilis. This is first stage syphilis. And think of this in terms of the enemy initially getting in to the fortress. This is the chancre is literally the entry point for the spirochetes. And it may be a small number of spirochetes. It may be a larger number of spirochetes. But this is where they're getting in. This is the hole in the fortress wall.
Yeah, and these chancres can appear usually around 21 days after infection, but sometimes as little as 10 or even 90 days.
Yeah, and they may hang around for 3 to 6 weeks. And here's the thing. They can, if you look up pictures online, and sure, you should definitely go and do a Google image search for what these look like.
Gird your loins.
But they may look pretty intense at times, but these are painless, and they're easily confused with any number of small skin ailments that may pop up in even a healthy person's life. You know, the stuff like ingrown hairs or various other bumps that may be caused by any number of other ailments. Again, it's the great imitator.
Right. Now, if you do not get treated at this point, well, then it gets into secondary syphilis. And during this stage, that's when you see those skin rashes, sores in your mouth.
And so that's the primary stage. And it's key to note here that the chancre disappears. It vanishes. So if you were concerned about it, if you were like, I wonder what this painless, ugly spot on my genitals is, well, then it goes away. And that's one of the dangers that we see over and over again with syphilis, is that the infection seems to go away. The illness may seem to go away, but as we're about to learn, it does not.
And again, imagine yourself in, the 15th century, if you have this, and then that disappears. You think, oh, everything is fine.
Yeah.
Right?
Ooh, so, I was upset over nothing.
Ingrown hair.
And maybe you didn't even notice. It's entirely likely that one wouldn't even notice that the chancre had popped up.
Now, most likely you wouldn't have been treated at that point in time, because there wasn't anything necessarily to treat you with that was really effective. So it would then develop into a secondary stage called secondary syphilis, in which you would have skin rashes and or sores in your mouth, vagina, and anus, also called mucous membrane lesions.
Yeah, and you may also see other varying symptoms, such as fever, lethargy, headaches, general body aches, hair loss. And this is the point in the invasion in which the enemy made it in the primary stage. And in secondary syphilis, the enemy has spread throughout the castle. All right, and is making itself known throughout the invaded city that is the human body.
Right, and you are highly contagious at this point. In fact, genital sores caused by syphilis make it a lot easier to transmit and acquire things like HIV infection, right? So you can get a secondary infection at this point. In fact, there is an estimated 2- to 5-fold increased risk of acquiring HIV if you're exposed to infection when syphilis is present in these first and second stages.
Now, at this point, after secondary syphilis. And here again, we see that the secondary syphilis, this outbreak period, this goes away as well, which again could lead someone to say, well, that was horrible. And maybe they may not even realize that it was connected to the primary outbreak. And they might, but they can easily imagine, well, I'm done with this now. It's done. It's finished. Whatever illness was affecting me, the pox has left me, right?
Yeah, but little do they know that this is just the latent stage of this. And it's just waiting around. It might not even reveal itself for decades.
Yeah. So imagine the enemy has invaded the castle. They've made a lot of mischief, and then suddenly they seem to be gone. But they're not gone.
They're in the basement.
They're in the basement. They're in every house in the city. They've literally become a part of the city. They're essentially a sleeper cell, and that is what latent syphilis is.
Tertiary syphilis, the stage, really is quite gruesome because it kind of takes everything in the body down to the studs, or more so, I should say. It's like you say, the sleeper cells in the basement, they become stronger and they come roaring back into the body and they cause a lot of havoc.
Yeah. We see this over and over again with syphilis, but it has such metaphorical power is one of the reasons that I think we're, aside from its power to harm and disfigure us, the reason we're drawn to it so is you do see this idea of the infection. It flared up, then it flared up again, and then it comes back in only 15% to 30% of the cases, a much stronger form in the tertiary stage, far more debilitating, far more destructive, and ultimately lethal stage of the illness.
Yeah. In this late stage, you could have symptoms that include difficulty coordinating your muscle movements, paralysis, not being able to move some of your body, numbness, blindness, and dementia. And then in the late stages, the disease begins to ravage your internal organs, and that is what can result in death.
And this, one of the remarkable things about this is that this stage can occur 10 to 20 years after primary syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
So this is – it's again, the metaphorical power of this, it's like the sins of the young individual coming back to destroy the older individual, you know? It's gruesome stuff. And again, so one may not even remember that first outbreak all that clearly. And
yeah,
then suddenly all these changes are happening to their body and ultimately to their mind.
Yeah. And we have largely up until this point treated this in a very clinical fashion and not really talked about the sights and the sounds and the smells of what this looks like, mm-hmm. which we'll do more in the next podcast. But just know that at this point, this is really adding injury to insult, because you might have lost your nose, you know, and recovered from that. And all of a sudden you think you're out in the clear, and boom, it comes back in such a corrosive manner that you find out that this is really the death knell.
Yeah, corrosive is an excellent term to use, because you see the loss of teeth, you see the destruction of the palate and the mouth, you see the collapse of the nose into what is known as saddle nose,
mm-hmm.
Where basically the nose collapses around the bridge and becomes kind of upturned and smaller looking, and then may eventually appear to rot entirely. Saddle nose is also caused can also be caused by just damage to the nose. You'll
yeah.
see boxers that suffer from saddle nose. Also, extreme cocaine addiction can sometimes have that effect on individuals. But yeah, you're seeing it attack your facial features. You're seeing it attack your genitals in a very destructive manner. And then also getting into your organs. Back to the quote that I read at the beginning of the podcast by Dr. William Osler, the spirochetes of syphilis attack every part of the body, like nothing is off limits. To go back to that castle analogy from earlier, the invader has lived in the city for 10 to 20 years, and now in potentially every household in the city has decided to just burn everything to the ground.
Right. Now, the other part of this is that syphilis, as we have mentioned before, can be transmitted through the placenta. So what does this mean? It means that during that time period from the 15th century to the 20th century, there are a lot of children born with syphilis, also called congenital syphilis.
And even to this day, according to the World Health Organization, you have 1 million children born annually with congenital syphilis.
Yeah, and it's very serious stuff, because nearly half of all children infected with syphilis while they're in the womb die shortly before or after birth. And sometimes this can also result in stillborns.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that syphilis can be cured with antibiotics, if caught early, there are rising rates among pregnant women in the United States. And that, of course, has increased the number of infants born with this. Now, some of the complications include blindness, deafness, deformity of the face, and nervous system problems.
Now, why does syphilis hang out in the body so long, you might be wondering? Well, it may be due in part to T. pallidum having a slow dividing time of 30 to 33 hours. And it's likely that T. pallidum undergoes an even slower rate of division during the latent stages of the disease. So it's a long-living creature from a bacterial standpoint.
Yeah, so it's like a bacterial crock pot.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the current state of treatment in infections. Oh, but I say current. I have to mention that there are a couple old-timey ways in which there are thought to be cures for it, one of which is mercury.
Yes, mercury.
Yes, inhaling mercury vapor. In fact, this was so common for hundreds of years that a little phrase came out of that, a night with Venus, a lifetime with mercury.
Yeah, so you would find yourself going regularly for essentially skin treatments, taking these mercury steam baths, mm-hmm. and enduring the harmful effects of that mercury inhalation on top of the ravages of syphilis.
It did kill the spirochete, but yes, it also poisoned the patient.
Yeah, well, there are a few different factors involved there, because on one hand, there are arguments to what effect the mercury had in killing the spirochetes, but then the spirochetes are so entrenched in the body, what can you do? Also, again, think about that primary and secondary stage, the flare-ups and the disappearance. You have individuals that could go to be treated for their symptoms of syphilis, and lo and behold, the symptoms vanish with the treatment, not because of the treatment, but just because of the timing of the treatment. And ultimately, again, you're dealing with 4.5 centuries in which there is no cure for this illness. So if someone's trying to sell you an illness, you're going to try and buy it. That's just how it goes. And, you know, if this disease is ravaging my body, if you tell me that mercury might help, then I'm probably going to try mercury.
Sure, you're going to try anything at that point, including malaria, which was apparently something that was discovered in 1917 by Julius Wagner Jarig to help halt some of the symptoms of syphilis, particularly neurosyphilis, that advanced stage in which you get psychosis and you get paralysis. And they found that if you induced a malarial fever in patients, well, that could help with the actual infection.
You also saw the use of so-called syphilization treatments. This was where you would essentially try to inoculate the patient in the same way that you would treat them for smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't work.
This is submitting yourself to the disease, right?
Right, yeah, trying to build up bodily immunity. Doesn't work. Now, I've read some mixed reports of how experiments on rabbits in the modern age have potentially shown some possibility there, but you get into a situation where it would take so many applications of syphilis, and we're talking about a rabbit, and it hasn't been studied enough, and you would certainly could not study it in humans. So, and then also, why study it when we have penicillin that can wipe it out?
And sometimes it's diagnosed by testing fluid from a syphilis sore and looking for the spirochete via dark field microscopy.
The name of that blood test, by the way, is the Wasserman blood test, and it was developed in 1906, just to get everything in the timeline squared away there.
So as we had mentioned, syphilis can be treated with antibiotics. So we're talking about penicillin, we're talking about G-benzatine, doxycycline, or tetracycline, and that's for patients who are usually allergic to penicillin. And the length of treatment depends on the extent of the infection and factors such as the person's overall health. So let's say you didn't get to it right away and you kind of get to the second or have a secondary phase of it, you would still have to deal with any sort of ill effects that you might have sustained at that point.
All right. So at this point, you might be wondering, what can I do to decrease my chances of catching syphilis? Well, according to the CDC, there are basically two things you can do, because there's no vaccine for syphilis. We have a cure for syphilis, but then again, you get into the problem of detecting it, knowing to report it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then even once you've treated syphilis, there's no undoing any damage that it's done. So, number one, be a part of a long-term mutually monogamous relationship with a partner who has been tested and has negative STD test results. And number two, use latex condoms the right way every time you have sex. Condoms prevent transmission of syphilis by preventing contact with a sore. Sometimes sores occur in areas not covered by a condom, however, and contact with these sores can still transmit syphilis. Because again, it's about it goes through the skin. It's not something that travels through the orifice.
Now, this might surprise you, but the people who really need to hear this most, besides 20 to 29-year-olds, mm-hmm. are senior citizens.
And this surprised me. This was some interesting material that you discovered.
Yeah, and we actually, a while ago, we had someone from the CDC come and talk to us about STDs, not because our group needed a talking to. But
because of the syphilis outbreak at work.
Right. No, but because every once in a while, someone will come and sort of give us information and it's always very interesting. And he had mentioned then that retirement communities, assisted living facilities, these are all hotbeds for STDs. And this is in part because they are not practicing safe sex. And also you have to keep in mind that that for a long time, perhaps many of the community members were in long-term relationships, but now they probably have lost a partner. And it's a very social community.
Okay.
There's a lot of sex going on with senior citizens in these communities. And numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show a rapid increase among older people. We're talking about between 2007 and 2011, chlamydia infections among Americans 65 and over increased by 31% and syphilis by 52%.
Wow. See, I had no idea. I end up struggling to try and piece together like a timeline for a hypothetical assisted living resident of how they acquire the syphilis and then how they end up passing it on to multiple people in the facility.
They just need to get the old posters, you know, from the 1940s and put them back up. And we'll talk more about that in the next episode.
Oh,
but
yes.
There were definite campaigns, trying to get some sort of awareness going with Americans about STDs.
Indeed. Yes, we'll get into all of that in our next episode titled Syphilis Through the Ages. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
This is part two of our little series here on syphilis. The first episode, Syphilis, the Great Imitator, dealt with the organism that causes syphilis, which is known as Treponema pallidum. Actually, it's a subspecies of Treponema pallidum. And this is all caused by this tiny, tightly coiled spirochete, this little bacterium that ends up causing all of this trouble for those that are infected. So if you have not listened to that first episode, go back, have a listen. We will walk you through all the stages of a syphilis infection, from the tiny annoyances of the primary infection on up to the disastrously deforming and ultimately lethal stages of tertiary syphilis,
as well as the treatment of it finally.
Yes.
All right. This has been mentioned in the other episode, but it bears mentioning again. The first recorded epidemic of venereal syphilis occurred in Europe in 1495. By the close of the 15th century, it was pretty rampant. In fact, in Naples, Italy, there was such a huge outbreak that the Pope said, hey, we need some help here. Soldiers were brought in. 25,000 of them. And what do you think happened? Well, they got to the prostitutes and they got more syphilis. And then, of course, it just got worse and worse. So what we're talking about is a disease that ravished for centuries throughout Europe. And today we're going to try to get at the origins of it. And we're going to try to tease out some of the morality that has been paired with it, as well as the sort of xenophobia that surrounds it as well.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, it's kind of difficult to overstate the importance of syphilis in Western culture for those 4.5+ centuries that it was a problem. And as we discussed in the last episode, syphilis is not eradicated. It is still around today. It's still something to be concerned about, and it's still something we have to treat both with penicillin and with education.
But during the 14th century to the early 20th century, it was really permeating the fabric of culture. It was rampant.
Yes. When we break down the percentages of it, it's going to vary depending on where in Europe you're looking, but you're generally looking at a 10% to 15% of the population has syphilis, with some degree, margin for error there. And then upwards of 20% in military, because, again, you have younger men who are potentially traveling around, and they are the ones that are spreading it from place to place, visiting prostitutes, etc.
Yeah, and because of its association with Columbus, who sailed under the Spanish flag, it was called the Spanish disease for a while, and then the French called it the Neapolitan or Italian disease because they caught it from residents of Naples, or so they say. When Naples, of course, was one of the major outbreak areas. The Russians called it a Polish disease. The Polish called it a Russian disease. And the Turks called it a Christian disease, while the English called it the French pox. So what do you see here? A lot of finger pointing.
Yes, it's always the other that you blame the disease on. You have to draw that firm line in your worldview between we the clean and they the diseased and hope that that line doesn't come to envelop you as well. The Columbus thing is so fascinating, and it's a point that is continually studied and argued about. But again, we see that first big outbreak in 1495,
mm-hmm.
and as we all know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean
blue.
Yeah, so it sounds almost too good to be true / too horrible to be true. It almost sounds too easy,
mm-hmm.
But we keep coming back to it time and time again. Here we have Columbus sailing to this drastically new land, and their contact, be it sexual or merely skin on skin, is occurring between members of his crew and the native population, and then they return to Europe. And then in their wake, we see the emergence of this powerful illness.
Yeah, and you see a lot of wrong-headed ideas about this idea of xenophobia, right? This fear of strangers, this idea that there are savages that have spread this disease to Europeans via Columbus.
Yeah, you laid with a member of another nation. You laid with a member of another race. All of these weird taboos spring up and seemingly in concert with the parameters of the illness. As we mentioned before, one of the reasons that syphilis is such a captivating topic is because it's so rife for metaphor, you know, be it a metaphor of morality, a metaphor of racism, nationalism, sexism, whatever you want to throw at it. It seems to conform to that form rather nicely.
Yeah. Now, we will get back to Columbus, and we're going to try to get to the origins of syphilis. But before we do, it's just worth it to say that this is syphilis, and trying to get to the origins of it is really difficult. It's very hard to study. Mm-hmm. There are many strains, some of which don't exist anymore. And then you have anecdotal claims throughout the centuries. So you can't really pair that with, you know, a systematic approach to say, yes, indeed, this was a case of syphilis. Because, again, as we have mentioned before, syphilis is the great imitator. So it's very possible that someone had leprosy and not syphilis.
Exactly. And again, on that difficult to study note, you can't grow syphilis in a culture. You can't have a little petri dish of syphilis, even today. We have to study it in rabbits.
Mm-hmm. So, right, you have to have it in an actual organism to really get a good idea about it. That being said, there have been these pre-Columbian theories kicked around. In other words, this idea of, hey, could syphilis have existed before the New World, previous to the late 1400s in the Old World? That's, again, called the pre-Columbian theory.
Yeah, and this theory is basically that, to say that, well, we have other illnesses. If you look back at some accounts of leprosy, you might say, well, that account of leprosy doesn't match up as well with our modern understanding of leprosy. Perhaps that was a different ailment. Perhaps that was, in fact, syphilis. And instead, we're just kind of latching on to this easy explanation of Columbus, since this groundbreaking expedition takes place just a few years before this major outbreak. But of course, the world – because, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, the world is more complicated than one ship sailing off and coming back. There are other movements going on in the world. It's a time of great change.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving around, not only throughout Europe, but you have movements going into Asia and Africa. So why not? Why could there not be another route for this illness to take?
And we'll discuss it. We'll really try to get to the bottom of this. But when we say pre-Columbian, we're talking about Old World. When we talk about Columbian, we're talking about New World generally here.
Yeah. Old World is Europe. Old World is Western civilization. New World, the Americas, Columbia, etc.
Right. And if you're going to talk about New World, you have to talk about something called yaws and basal. Now, these are tropical diseases that are closely related to treponema pallidum, which is, of course, syphilis. Although they are different, Bagel causes mouth sores and lumps in the bone, and yaws cause skin sores and disfiguring growths on the leg. So, of course, they're related to syphilis, but they are non-venereal.
Right, they're spread through skin-to-skin contact. They're not they're not straight up venereal diseases. You know, granted, you could catch them in skin-to-skin contact during sexual intercourse, but they're not depending on that as their mode of transmission. But these are all treponemal diseases. These are all close relatives of the subspecies of Treponema pallidum that causes syphilis.
And we bring them up because they're important to study. If you're trying to look at where syphilis originated from, then you're going to want to look at Yaws and Bagel, because paleopathologist Bruce and Christine Rothschild used that information to point toward a new world origin of syphilis. They examined 687 skeletons from archaeological sites in the U.S. And we're talking about ranging in age from 400 to 6,000 years. And what they found is that populations to the south looked to have syphilis, while those to the north had yaws. And then by contrast, they examined 1,000 old world skeletons dating to before contact with the new world, and they found zero cases of syphilis. So this kind of gets you onto the route of, well, maybe the new world did have the case of syphilis, although it's not that clear cut, as we'll discuss.
And this leads us to what is called the Unitarian hypothesis, which has nothing to do with Unitarians in the religious sense of the word. Don't worry, Unitarians, we're not nailing this one on you. Unitarian in the sense that it unites the old world and new world hypotheses regarding the emergence of syphilis in Europe. The basic idea here is that you do have Columbus and his sailors setting sail from Europe to the new world, to the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're there, they do come into skin-to-skin contact, sexual and non-sexual, with natives there. And then they end up acquiring treponemal diseases. Now, you know, again, think to Bagel, think to Penta, think to Yaws, but not necessarily syphilis proper. But they bring back a relative of syphilis, and they bring it back to a drastically new incubation world. We're talking about a different environment, because in the Americas, individuals with syphilis, they're going to largely be in, you know, smaller communities. But then you bring them to a European port town. You bring it to a world where individuals are wearing more clothes, thus allowing for less skin-on-skin contact. You're bringing it to a world where you have brothels, a world where you have tiny ships tightly packed with men sailing from one port to the next port throughout Europe. And what happens, according to this hypothesis, is that the treponemal disease changes, and we get this subspecies of Treponema pallidum that causes syphilis as we know it. So it is a story of mutation under new environmental circumstances.
Yeah, if anyone is interested in taking a deeper dive into this and some of the skeletal evidence behind this, there is a paper, a 2012 paper called The Science Behind Pre-Columbian Evidence of Syphilis in Europe, Research by Documentary. And that goes into this much more. And I wanted to quote Molly Zuckerman. She's one of the authors of the paper. She says, in reality, it appears that venereal syphilis was the byproduct of two different populations meeting and exchanging a pathogen. It was an adaptive event, the natural selection of a disease independent of morality or blame.
Yeah. It's not a situation of, oh, those sinful sailors or, oh, those diseased natives in this new world. It's something more complicated than that.
Yeah. And, you know, at the outset of this, the researchers for this paper, they really wanted to sort of disprove this idea that Columbus and his crew were vectors for syphilis, because they thought it can't be that just, you know, Columbus and his guys hung out in America and then brought it back to Europe and spread syphilis all over the place. Can't be that simple. And it's not that simple. You know, because the trick here is that it mutated, it adapted, rather. But they went into it with the intent of saying, nah, can't be.
Yeah, because it does sound like something you would read in sort of a conspiracy theory kind of message board, right? Like, well, these two dates line up. We can correlate this a little bit. Therefore, that must be what happened. Now we do want to drive home that these are all hypotheses and that this is still an area that everyone's – there are a lot of papers that come out about this. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of argument, a lot of disagreement. So there's no definitive answer here. And it may indeed be one of those areas where we never have a definitive answer.
It's true. And, you know, the researchers who worked on that paper also worked on – some of them worked on a different paper looking at 54 published reports of pre-Columbian evidence and skeletal remains of syphilis. And they found there that, again, there wasn't enough supporting information and real evidence to say that it existed in its form of syphilis, as we know it and talk about it now, in the old world. So again, there seems to be some sort of direction here in terms of the way the river is streaming with information, but it doesn't mean that this is the end point of the origins of syphilis. And we're going to talk about more of the sort of sights and sounds and smells of what it might be like in a syphilitic era in Europe. And I wanted to just read this. This is from the BBC, A Cultural History of Syphilis. It says, in the 1490s, an apparently new and terrifying disease struck Naples in southern Italy and swept fire-like across Europe, reaping a dreadful human cost. It must have been as though hell had come to earth. Pustules spread across the genitals in the face of its many sufferers, unbearable gastrointestinal pain followed upon fevers, screamingly severe headaches and other symptoms. Finally, flesh fell from bones. Syphilis had arrived in Europe, where it would stay misunderstood, lacking any form of cure for nearly 500 years.
Yeah, that's pretty rough sounding. And again, remember that this was not a disease that affected just the poor. This was a disease that affected rich and poor alike, that affected royalty and peasant, that affected clergy members. Anyone that was engaging in sexual contact ran the risk, a high risk of acquiring this illness.
And yeah, this was not a quiet sort of illness. I mean, people could smell you before you even came around. We're talking about rotting flesh. We are talking about your face bearing the marks of syphilis, your body bearing the marks of it. In fact, you could even kind of see it as a sort of scarlet letter A rot into your flesh.
Yeah. Again, the metaphorical power of syphilis is unavoidable here because you already have the idea in Western culture that physical deformities may signal inner deformities, that an inner sin can have a fleshly manifestation. And it's super easy to apply that line of thinking to syphilis because here is something that is spread through sex. Here is something that is spread through sin, if you will, and then has these terrifying physical manifestations, certainly in its later stages. So it's easy then for someone to point the figure and say, this is the way, these are the wages of sin right here. All you have to do is look at this individual, look at the sores on their body, look at the deformities of their facial feature, look what has happened to them. And so you see this just throughout its throughout its 4.5 centuries of unchecked rampaging, and even beyond into the 20th century, and even into the 21st, there is a moral aspect to syphilis and to other venereal diseases. This is something you caught because you were doing something that was wrong. Like that's the script that is often applied to the scenario.
Yeah, and now people have the sort of calling card hallmarks of that disease, right?
Right.
They look at you and they say, oh, let me see. You've got a nasty rash there. You've lost your hair.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps your nose is even caving in into what's called saddle nose. And so what do people do? Well, they try to find anything and everything that might cover up their transgressions or what would be perceived as transgressions.
Right. And bear in mind, again, through all of this, that there are no set of standard symptoms for syphilis. And there are stages where it's undetectable. So everyone's going crazy with ways to detect and treat it, while the illness itself is so difficult to get your hands on. It's the great imitator. It's the great hider. So yeah, bad stuff is happening to your body in the varying stages of syphilis. So one thing you might do is, you may cover things up. Since we are wearing clothes, we're wearing makeup, you can apply clothing and makeup to cover up your sores.
Yeah. In fact, syphilis just creates this whole cottage industry of different things you can buy and do to either feel better or look better. Mm-hmm. So there might be some sort of snake oil that you can buy, right, that has absolutely no medical merit. Or you might visit your local wig maker quite a bit because, again, you want to cover up the bald patch on your head or the baldness so that people don't suspect that you have syphilis. And if you are a prostitute, a merkin is a must.
Because, yeah, you might be shaving your pubic hair anyway to cut down on lice, but then you also might have an outbreak of syphilis down there. You want to disguise the signs, so you get a wig for your genitals.
Also called a merkin, which is not a Muppet character.
Yeah. They're apparently used a lot now for films, especially historical films.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But historically, it was more a matter of venereal diseases. For the men, generally wasn't really an option because there's just more to cover up down there. And just do a Google image search. You'll see what I'm talking about.
All right. Yeah. There are some logistics there that you can't quite cover with a merkin. But what happens when your nose caves in and your flesh begins to rot away?
Well, this creates a problem. And in general, it was kind of a rough time for noses anyway. If you remember the story of Tycho Brahe, the astronomer, I think we did an episode on mm-hmm. him, or at least he comes up a time.
We did an episode,
yeah. Yeah, fascinating individual. There may be some biographers that creep syphilis in there, but I think it's pretty established that he lost the nose in a duel. So mm-hmm. on one level, you can lose that nose in a duel, living an adventurous lifestyle, getting yourselves into arguments with other armed gentlemen. But you can also acquire syphilis through your adventurous lifestyle, and then you see the saddle nose, the eventual rotting away of the nose. So one thing you can do is you can buy a fake nose to wear over your destroyed nose. And this is as simple as it sounds. If you've ever seen a Digital Underground video and you've seen Humpty Hump with the big fake nose on his face, who incidentally, according to the backstory, lost it in a frying accident, I believe.
So, sure.
So no dueling or syphilis involved with Humpty. But it's basically the same scenario. A fake nose that is strapped onto the body or held with wires over the vacant area.
Yeah, in fact, and this is according to Lindsay Fitzharris, who is a medical historian and writes on the Chirurgeon Apprentice, which is a great website documenting medical surgeries. She writes that this deformity was so common amongst those suffering from the pox, as it was sometimes called, that no-nose clubs sprung up in London. On February 18th, 1874, the Star reported, "Miss Sanborn tells us that an eccentric gentleman, having taken a fancy to see a large party of noseless persons, invited everyone thus afflicted whom he met in the streets to dine on a certain day at a tavern, where he formed them into a brotherhood." And on this site, again, that Lindsay Fitzharris has put together, there is a great example of one of these sort of noses that's attached to a pair of glasses that's attached to a sort of almost looks like a headgear, like early headgear braces. And it's one that that a female patient wore.
Yeah, and you can imagine that worn with a wig, and it makes perfect sense. And you know, the no-nose club also makes a lot of sense, because if you're dealing with this illness, you're having to cover yourself up and wear this fake nose over your face. I mean, there's going to come a time when you want to be able to just take that off and be yourself, no matter what has happened to yourself in this illness. You want to be able to just say, "Hey, here we are. We may not have noses anymore because of this illness, but hey, we're people, and we want to look at each other like we're people, and not worry about, oh, whatever, you know, all these other people that don't have syphilis or don't realize they have syphilis or in other stages of the illness are looking at me and judging me for what I am and making judgments about my moral character based on what has happened."
Well, and Fitzharris has that blog post, Syphilis, A Love Story, which essentially talks about this. And I believe it is Miss Sanborn who eventually takes the fake nose off at her husband's request because he accepts her as she is.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to that BBC program, The Cultural History of Syphilis, which I'll link to on the landing page for this podcast episode. But they go into some of the cases of individuals, particularly in the 17th century, who end up, if not finding pride in their syphilitic appearance, they at least, you know, come to own it. You see individuals like Sir William Davenant, 1606 through 1668, is a poet, playwright, and he was famously not shy about being painted or depicted in artwork without a false nose. So you see a very sunken saddle nose, you know, almost vacant, you know, part of his facial features, and he was, you know, pretty upfront about it. Another instance, you have artist Gerard de Lauris, 1641 through 1711, who was actually a prominent painter, and he was born with congenital syphilis. And he was – there's actually a painting of him by Rembrandt, which I'll put on the blog for everyone to see, because it's a Rembrandt piece, so it's splendid to behold. But here's an individual who, you know, he's sitting for a portrait. He's open and free about who he is. You know, he's not trying to hide it at this point. And you see a number of individuals, John Wilmot, the second Earl of Rochester, who was portrayed by Johnny Depp in the movie Libertine. You see individuals like this who basically say, yeah, I have syphilis. I've had a wild life, and the wages of having that wild life are syphilis. So it's almost like a badge of honor. Yeah, it's like when you hear – I've heard people say point at rock stars, aging rock stars, and, you know, say, ooh, they look rough. But they partied hard to get there, you know, to say that, you know, what has happened to them is like a badge of honor, because it says they have enjoyed their younger life, and that is why their older form is so decrepit. And that's what you're seeing in some of these individuals. Now, granted, these are individuals that were living at in the upper echelon of society, so they had a little more room to you know, to grab onto that pride. They weren't dying of syphilis, you know, in the slums. And likewise, some of these individuals, too, also had taken to various ideas about how syphilis could be treated. So they thought that perhaps their syphilis was being treated and managed by regular mercury treatments in one of those mercury steam baths, which, as we mentioned in the previous episode, was likely making their symptoms worse in some cases.
So they thought that, A, they were above sort of some of the social rules in place because of their position in society, and B, that they might have been vanquishing it. So they were not quite as concerned about how they looked, perhaps.
Yeah, and if you're looking at the body from a less religious standpoint, and you're looking at more from a hedonistic or even mechanical standpoint, you're saying, hey, I live in a world in which syphilis exists. And if I behave a certain way, syphilis is what happens to my body, you know? Some of these cases too, you see individuals where they're almost happy when they finally catch syphilis, because it means, if nothing else, it means they don't have to worry about catching syphilis anymore. You know, they're no longer living in the shadow of syphilis, but within the dark of syphilis. And you can see where there might be a certain amount of empowerment there. Certainly, if you have to latch onto something, you might as well latch onto that.
Although, again, you'd have to be in a really specific social position to do that. And you'd have to be a male for certain.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Now, if you had the money, the wherewithal, and you did not want to wear a fake nose, or you weren't ready to come out to the world that you had syphilis, then you would try a kind of nasal reconstruction, which in the 16th century was called the Indian method. And this involved cutting a nose-sized section of skin from the forehead. So there's, again, another calling card or hallmark that you have the disease, because your nose looks great, but you got a big patch of skin missing from your forehead.
Hey, but you have a really big wig.
That's true.
So you end up covering
that up. You have a nice wig. But they take that skin from the forehead, and they would attach it to the bridge of the nose to maintain a steady blood supply, and then that flap was twisted into place and sewn over the damaged area, which kind of created a replacement nose. But again, it wasn't perfect in, you know, really cold weather. It would not turn the same color as the rest of your nose. So there were certain telltale signs that it may look like an intact nose, but it is not your perhaps nose that you were born with. But it turns out that there's a better and perhaps more horrific way to take a stab at plastic surgery or early plastic surgery.
Yeah, well, it is tempting to say it's horrific, but in another way, it's kind of beautiful, and it gets at how malleable our flesh really is. Because again, modern plastic surgery, the plastic is referring to the plasticity of the flesh, that you can craft flesh into a form.
Yeah, and actually this method did and does inform plastic surgeons about how skin grows and how you can mold it and sculpt it. So,
yeah, in this we see the 16th century advent of the Italian method. Now, to picture this, if you don't have an image of it in front of you, and if you're not driving a car or doing anything where you need your hands, place your palm of your hand kind of on your forehead, okay? And then allow your nose to touch your arm. That is basically the position where the surgeon would lock your arm into place. There'd be like a head vice type of scenario going on so that you could not move your arm away. You could not move the flesh of your arm away from the flesh of your face. And then that's where you perform the skin graft. You walk a pedicle of flesh. You sort of cut it away from the forearm. Then you stitch it into place where the nose should be, in place of the nose that you've lost to syphilis or duels or what have you. And then that's held in place while the grafted skin grows onto the face. So for a brief period of time, you have effectively sewn your arm, or a surgeon has effectively sewn your arm to your face. And then once the graft is taken, then you cut the arm away from it. And you've essentially walked a piece of flesh off of your arm onto your face and then used that to form a new nose.
Which is kind of brilliant. I mean, honestly, you ask a plastic surgeon about this and they'll be like, this is a great way to try to get the skin to graft onto other skin and then be able to shape it. Mm-hmm. The only problem here is that for about 2 weeks, you're walking around with your hand stuck to your head and you can't really move your nose, right? Because that's now stuck to your arm.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're probably not doing a whole lot of walking around town like that, but... But yeah, there's going to be a weird period there. But you know, the Italian method, it's a remarkable what it can do. Like, it may be summoning images of like a really bad plastic surgery job or something.
Yeah.
But I've seen some images, particularly late 1800s, early 1900s, in which you see multiple pedicles of flesh that are essentially walked up the body to the face to repair individuals who, say, lost their lower jaw to gunshot wound. And then you're able to walk all these pedicles up to the face, and it looks kind of ghastly at first, but then you start putting them in their place. And at the end of this series of procedures, you have a much more normal-looking visage there in place of the damaged tissue. So in this scenario, we see the impact of syphilis on early rhinoplasty in Europe. But we also see other ways in which syphilis ends up changing the way that medicine is practiced throughout the old world. For instance, it immediately challenged humorism and the doctrine of contagion that was prevalent of the day. We also see syphilis as a catalyst for modern doctor-patient confidentiality, because suddenly it becomes a kind of a calling card for some doctors. Hey, let me treat you for your syphilis because I'll keep it on the down low. Now we just kind of take that for granted that we go into a doctor, they're not going to blab about syphilis to everyone in the neighborhood.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This is another key fact that was brought up in the book Clean by Virginia Smith that I've referenced before in podcasts, and that is that previously you'd go into your local barber shop, and you'd have the barber tonsors in the front, the barber surgeons in the back. Have your hair cut, your face shaved, all of that. That'd take place in the front of the building. You'd go into the back, into the yard or what have you. That's where you would receive minor surgeries. That's where you would take a bath and later, as syphilis begins to spread, that's where you start getting treated for syphilis. That's where you might take your mercury bath. And so the prevalence of the disease and fear regarding the disease, this leads to regulation. This leads to, of course, paranoia. And so you see the two separate. So you see the separation of the barber tonsor and the barber surgeon.
That's right, because that red and white striped barber pole used to indicate that there were surgeries done there, right? In case anybody's ever wondered why that pole is outside of a hair cuttery. All right, so that's its impact on medicine and medical surgeries, as well as cottage industries like wig makers, right?
Yes.
And people who are selling, snake oils. But there are certain things that you cannot cover up here when it comes to syphilis. And one of the things would be your teeth. Now, you could pull out your teeth. You could put dentures in. But if you didn't want to do that, you're kind of saddled with the ravages of your teeth by syphilis.
Yeah. And one of the more particular things we see here with the teeth is something that pops up in cases of congenital syphilis. And that's something known as Hutchinson teeth. These are as with all things syphilis, the exact symptoms vary, but this is often typified by sharpened-looking teeth or peg-shaped teeth that kind of have sharpened points on the edges.
Mm-hmm.
You can look for images of this online. I think I did a blog post that I'll link to on the landing page for this podcast episode that includes the image that Julie and I are both looking at now. But they do have a kind of a monstrous appearance. These are like sharpened teeth inside of a human mouth.
Particularly canine teeth.
Yes.
And so we start to look at this for a little bit, and naturally your mind would turn to vampire teeth because that's kind of what this looks like. It looks like a sort of Nosferatu version of vampire teeth.
Yeah, and it's led some commentators to argue that the evolution of the vampire myth in Western civilization may have connections to cases of congenital or hereditary syphilis. The children are born like this. They have this kind. They could have, in addition to these teeth, they may also have elongated fingers. They may have an elongated skull. There are various other deformities that might be interpreted as monstrous by somebody taking in the scenario. And another connection between vampires and syphilis arguably takes us to Bram Stoker himself, the author of the book Dracula. And another area where vampires and syphilis seem to converge is in the case of the 1897 novel Dracula by Bram Stoker. Now, Bram Stoker's exact cause of death, and he died in 1912, it remains, you know, somewhat something of a mystery. But some biographers attribute his death to tertiary syphilis and make the further argument that Dracula itself, as a literary work, is kind of reflecting not only the paranoia regarding syphilis that's present in the culture, but also Stoker's own experience with the illness itself. Because you look at vampires, you look at Dracula, and you see something that is at once sexual and monstrous. You see this outsider that has come to, in this case, to England, and is spreading this illness of vampirism, this alien pathogen to women in the area.
Yes, they are puncturing the women, right?
Yes.
So again, you have to use that metaphor, which always comes up, sex and vampires, right? Yeah, in fact, you sent me this link to a class that's offered. The class is The Vampire in Literature and Cinema, taught by Tomislav Lajinovic, who is a professor of Slavic and comparative literature. And he uses that vampire lore to explore folkloric explanations of disease epidemics. Which makes sense, right? Especially if you're caught up in this. You'll say it's the 16th century, it's the 17th century, and this is this, you know, pervasive disease, and you have all of these sort of myths surrounding it. It's possible that people could sort of extrapolate, like, maybe there are vampires. Maybe this is how it's being spread.
Yeah, because again, 4.5 centuries in which we could not cure it, so you're throwing what you can at it. You're throwing actual research. You're throwing snake oil. You're throwing mercury steam baths. You're throwing religion. You know, because again, it just can't be overstated the connection between morality and syphilis here, at least in the way that people tried to understand it, or at least ended up viewing it in society. And so, yeah, you throw in a little myth in there. You throw a little magical thinking and there you go. You can easily see the vampire emerge. Nothing concrete there, but some food for thought.
Yeah, which may be why a vampire in the form of Count Spirokit shows up in a Navy video in the 70s talking about STDs, right?
Yes, and you can watch this. I linked to the video on a blog post I did for Stuff to Blow Your Mind. It's actually a fabulous documentary. It's kind of the style of Schoolhouse Rocks.
Yeah.
But it
has a Scooby-Doo element to it as well.
Yeah, it's very silly look. Even when they get into some of the rougher stuff, such as congenital syphilis or actually showing illustrations of genitals, it's like the setup is very cartoon. It's Death himself is having an award ceremony, handing out the coveted Fourth Horseman Award for a disease that's done the best work in causing misery and death around the world. And who should win it but Count Spirokit, who represents syphilis. The embodiment of gonorrhea takes some issue with it. Some of the other illnesses are like, what's so great about Spirokit? What's he doing? There's a cure for it, blah, blah, blah. And so Death and Spirokit, mainly Death, goes on to explain to us why how syphilis works and why it is a problem and why enlisted Navy men, why sailors should be on guard and should go seek treatment for anytime they have any kind of a flare-up.
Which kind of gets into this whole rich tradition of the military trying to bring a level of awareness of STDs to everyone. In fact, if you go back to World War I and World War II, you will see all sorts of pamphlets and posters warning military members to be very careful, to watch out for SIF, watch out for gonorrhea. And it even reminded me of our quarantine episode in which we talked about the U.S. military quarantining prostitutes in an attempt to try to separate what they thought as disease-carrying prostitutes with STDs from military members.
Yeah, so you have these campaigns that are basically – in essence, saying, hey, sailors, when you go into the next port town, please stay away from the prostitutes because you could catch syphilis and it's bad news. And you have to bear in mind, too, that even after the advent of penicillin, you'll have situations, particularly in wartime, where there's not an unlimited amount of penicillin to throw at your Navy men's venereal diseases. A lot of that penicillin is earmarked for the battlefield, for use in helping with soldiers who've been injured in combat. You don't want to spend it all just on a bunch of horny sailors who can't control themselves when they go into a foreign port of call. So they're throwing education at the problem as well. But they're speaking to a male audience, and so the messaging tends to take on a very sexist feel.
Yeah. In fact, one of the posters, which I'm looking at right now, is a really good example. It's this it's a photograph of a girl that looks, you know, kind of innocent and pure and, you know, very,
very Norman Rockwell. Like, this is a Norman Rockwell gal I'm looking at.
Very Norman Rockwell. In fact, she has this sort of beatific smile on as if, you know, she's doing godly work. And then there are, you know, some servicemen who are looking at her at a distance. And across this poster, it says, "She may look clean, but..." And the butt is in all red and all caps. And it says, "Pickups, good time girls, prostitutes, spread syphilis and gonorrhea. You can't beat the Axis if you get VD." And what I think is so interesting about this is that there are many other posters that have more, I don't know, what would you say, tawdry looking women that they are basically saying they're prostitutes. But then you have this other sort of, like I said, beatific, smiled, innocent-looking girl. And the point is, as you say, is that they're speaking to men, and they're really underscoring this idea that STDs, venereal diseases, all begin with women and that they are the font of evil.
Yeah, I mean, there's this darkness in the woman. It's almost like the feminine form as monster is the message here. And and you see, again, you do see some more fantastic, horrific visions of this. There's one where the woman is like moving a handheld mask away from her face, and behind it there's a death skull.
Yes. There's
Salvador Dali's illustration that he did for an anti-syphilis poster, in which you see the two buxom women that
melting.
Yeah, I guess they're kind of melting, but they look like a death skull. You know, it's one of those one of his classic style images where you see the death's head in the form of the women. I'll be sure to throw that on stuffedblowyourmind.com as well so everyone can see it.
And yeah, weren't you telling me about the 16th century hypothesis of the woman as really the germinator of syphilis?
Yeah. There was this notion that syphilis emerged because you had women, you had prostitutes who were having sex with multiple men, and then those different seeds would be inside her, and they would mingle together and corrupt into the form of syphilis. So, there was no proof to back up this ridiculous theory, but it did place the blame firmly on women, and very moralistically as well. These women are sinning, and therefore you have sickness arising from them. They are the source of the ailment itself.
Yeah, and not to get too crazy here, but it just kind of brings me back to this idea of witches, and we talked about witches, mm-hmm. and we talked about, you know, the power of women and sexuality. And again, here we are ascribing this sort of power, this death to women in the form of syphilis. And, I don't know that that's what all the poster artists intended, but it certainly captured the spirit of the times.
Yeah. And again, they were talking to a predominantly male audience. As we mentioned before, even over the centuries that syphilis was really ravaging Europe, you saw the highest percentages of infection in the soldiers, or certainly a higher percentage than in the rest of the population. So soldiers and prostitutes were a key area of transference.
Indeed.
All right, so there you have it. Again, there's not enough time, and even in a series of podcasts, to really get into all the ways that syphilis informed Western culture during its 4.5 centuries of unchecked life. But hopefully we hit some of the high points. We hit some of the ideas that were at play here about us versus the other, about men and women, about morality, about the cosmetics of dealing with syphilis. And if nothing else, it should serve as an interesting starting point for your own exploration of the topic.
And also touching on the origin of it as well, and knowing that we don't have the end-all, be-all theory in place yet, but we do have an idea of where it came from. All right. You guys can find us at a multitude of places.
Yeah, that's right. Go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. You will find all the blog posts, the podcasts, the videos, etc., including a number of different items related to this syphilis series that we've put out.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.